Today is Tuesday, June 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, plans continue to move forward for a U.S.-North Korea summit. Iran informs the U.N. it will begin boosting its uranium enrichment capacity.
The fact that they are sitting down and talking about potential peace is better than talking the way they were talking just 6 months ago.
Also ahead, a mattress from a Trump hotel is causing ethics concern for the Environmental Protection Agency boss. It's all on today's International Edition. South Korea's Yonhap news agency says North Korea's three top military leaders have been replaced. An intelligence agency source tells Yonhap the changes were made due to the new push toward détente with South Korea and the United States, noting that the three previous leaders lacked flexibility in thinking. The changes could be aimed at bringing the military in line ahead of a potential denuclearization deal between leader Kim Jong-un and U.S. President Donald Trump at their planned June 12th summit in Singapore. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders on Monday gave reporters a bit of information on the upcoming meeting.
The schedule for tentatively for that first meeting will be on June 12th at 9 a.m. Singapore time and take place at June 11th, 9 p.m. East Coast time.
Well, joining us now for more on what we may expect from the summit is former U.S. Ambassador, President of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. First, will this really happen?
I do expect that the summit will actually happen, and it is not only happening, but I think to the surprise of many like me, there's clearly an effort being made to prepare for it. You know, one of the fears that people had had was that the president would not prepare, that he'd go into the meeting unprepared. And while no one can guarantee what the president himself actually does, the fact is that there have been, I think, two or three preparatory meetings by American and North Korean teams in Korea. And there is a team, you know, preparing in Singapore and in other places. There are efforts to try to do what standard diplomatic practice would call for. So that's encouraging. Mm-hmm. It means that this very, very complex topic is at least something that, whether it's Pompeo or Bolton or whoever's doing this, is really trying to get a format laid out so that in the actual meeting, there will be points that they can discuss and agree about rather than just walking in and talking.
Do you think that anything definitive will actually come out of this meeting, or do you think this is more sort of a public relations type of situation?
Well, I'm always of the opinion that the president is always looking at his domestic base, no matter what he's doing. So there's always going to be that element of how does this play in terms of his domestic audience? You know, how is he going to do that? So in that sense, yes, of course, there's a PR element to this. And there's a PR element to, I think, what Kim Jong-un is doing. I mean, he is getting the first meeting by anyone in his family with an American president, which, you know, gives him a certain amount of prestige that he's wanted to have. So already there's that element of PR and image that's important to both men. But a deeper element of your question is, could something come out of this? It really does depend, in my mind, whether these talks that I've talked to you about, that I've mentioned, these preparatory talks, have led to a series of understandings about what the issues are. I mean, have they come to an agreement about what denuclearization means? Are they going to talk about a peace treaty that would end the Korean War, which has only been an armistice since 1953? Are they going to talk about the status of allies and what things allies would do and what would be the future of economic relations, whether there would be more sanctions or, as Trump has hinted, a reward, an economic reward for good behavior from the North Koreans? So whether those things have been actually worked out, we don't know, but it seems clear that they're being discussed, and it's not impossible something could come out of this.
Some analysts have said that really the North Koreans have already won, because this is something they've wanted for a very long time, just to be getting a photo op and getting, you know, the opportunity to have a sit down, and it sort of validates them.
Yeah, it has been the position of the Americans, you know, from Clinton through Bush through Obama, that you don't want to give that away without getting something in return. So many have been critical of the president for giving away that benefit. That said, this is an unusual president. He doesn't do things the way that other people do them. And my own feeling is the fact that they are sitting down and talking about potential peace is better than talking the way they were talking just 6 months ago about the potential for conflict. So, yes, you could say that he's broken with the tradition of previous presidents and has, quote, given, unquote, something to Kim Jong-un. But at least they're having these talks, and let's see what comes out of them.
All right, that's former U.S. Ambassador and President of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Guatemala volcano. Death toll is up and expected to rise. People of different faiths unite for a Muslim Ramadan meal. The first Saudi women get driver's licenses. And a U.S. top court sides with a baker in a gay wedding cake case. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Iran's Atomic Energy Organization spokesman tells ISNA News that Iran will inform the UN nuclear watchdog in Vienna on Tuesday over its start of a process to increase the country's uranium enrichment capacity. Iran's ultimate authority, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said Monday he had ordered preparations to increase uranium enrichment capacity if a 2015 nuclear deal with world powers falls apart after the U.S. withdrawal from it last month. European signatories of the accord back the deal, but have concerns over Iran's ballistic missile program and its influence in the Middle East. Iran says the two issues are non-negotiable. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Hussein Banai, assistant professor in international relations at Indiana University, if Iran is essentially restarting what it stopped after the deal.
Yes, except that the leader was very careful in his address to underline the fact that any kind of increased enrichment activity would still be under JCPOA. In other words, that Iran, as a goodwill measure, had halted or brought down its uranium enrichment capacity to levels lower than what had even been accepted to. And by restarting enrichment, Iran will just go all the way up to the line of what is permissible under the agreement. And it will stand there until it gets assurances from the Europeans that they will do everything they can to not undermine the deal any further by introducing other items. And if they do, then Iran would go over that threshold and would be ready to enrich even larger percentages of uranium.
Iran's nemesis, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, is touring Europe, specifically Germany, France, and Britain, signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, trying to get them to back away from that deal. But Chancellor Angela Merkel in Germany said she's going to stick to it for now. But is that deal now on life support with U.S. withdrawal?
It is. It's very difficult for the Europeans to be able to conduct any meaningful economic relations with Iran if the U.S. Treasury will hold any European companies into account by either fining those companies huge amounts of money or even banning their executive from entering the United States. So Europe has to pick and choose its battles going forward. I think everyone is in a kind of a holding pattern right now to see just how serious the Trump administration is in enforcing these sanctions, what kind of loopholes can be found in it where the Europeans can go around the agreement in a way that would satisfy both the United States but also their obligations under JCPOA. But the pressure applied by Israel here is meant to really also kind of ramp up a public pressure on the European government to apply more pressure on the Iranians when it comes to its involvement in what Israel considers to be its sphere of influence, its borders with Syria especially, but also with Lebanon and Jordan.
Interesting message that Mr. Netanyahu brought to Germany on Monday. He's warning that Iran's activities across the Middle East threaten to drive another wave of refugees to Europe. That's an interesting tack to take.
It is. It's a way to kind of connect and go directly into what is a hot-button issue in the European politics, the issue of the migrant flow and the refugee flow into Europe, which has really upended European politics and promises to do so in the next decade or so. By linking Iran directly to any kind of instability in the region that has caused this inflow of refugees into Europe, Netanyahu wants to signal to European public that basically until they stand firmly against Iran, that this issue is only going to get worse and it's going to destabilize European politics for years to come.
That's Hussein Banai, assistant professor in international relations at Indiana University. Meanwhile, the city of Paris has awarded a Malian immigrant for his bravery in saving a child last month. Mamadou Gassama has become an overnight hero and received French citizenship for his feat. But as Lisa Bryant reports from Paris, the accolades come as city police raised migrant camps just a few kilometers north, underscoring the broader polarized question of immigration roiling France and Europe.
22-year-old Mamadou Gassama received Paris's highest award Monday as Mayor Anne Hidalgo praised him as the city's and the country's hero. She nicknamed the Malian immigrant Spider-Man for his daring rescue of a 4-year-old dangling from a fourth-floor apartment balcony. That act of bravery has catapulted Gassama from illegal immigrant to French citizen with a budding career as fireman. But as Gassama is showered with praise, critics point to the very different fates facing other undocumented workers. That includes Ayman Latrousse, a Tunisian immigrant who saved a mother and her two children from a fire 3 years ago. Today, he may face expulsion. His lawyer is protesting unequal treatment. And hours before Gassama received his Paris award, hundreds of migrants were evicted from squatter camps just a few kilometers away under the watchful eye of French police. Afghan Abdul Kayem said he was glad to be leaving the tent camp, but another migrant cursed France and chose not to board a waiting bus.
Alors ils vont être hébergés dans un des 15 lieux d'hébergement.
Paris prefect François Javier says the migrants are guaranteed a place to stay thanks to newly built accommodation. They can apply for asylum. Those who do not qualify will be sent home. Meanwhile, the French Senate is debating immigration legislation already passed by the lower house. French President Emmanuel Macron's government says it will streamline asylum claims, among other pluses. Migrant rights groups criticize it as overly tough and even dangerous. While the French president says exemplary acts like Gassama's merit exemplary treatment, Louise Carr of Amnesty International France sees things differently.
We can't have these one-off actions where you've got a person who's compensated for acts of bravery. There are people sleeping on the streets. Refugees that continue to come to France need to be well received.
Gassama is not the first immigrant awarded French citizenship because of his bravery. Another Malian, Lassana Batili, was also hailed as a hero and awarded citizenship after helping hostages during a 2015 terrorist attack. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Environmental Protection Agency Chief Scott Pruitt had a top aide seek a used mattress from the Trump International Hotel and perform other personal chores for him, including house hunting and booking personal travel to a football game, according to testimony released Monday. EPA's Office of Inspector General, the Government Accountability Office, and the House Oversight Committee are all conducting a dozen separate investigations into alleged misspending and ethical missteps involving Pruitt and his top aides. Other recently disclosed examples of Pruitt seeking special treatment include his repeated use of first-class travel and directing his security staff to use lights and sirens to speed through Washington, D.C. traffic for dinner reservations. Joining us now to talk more about all of this is former EPA administrator and former governor of New Jersey, Christine Todd Whitman. What do you make of how Pruitt has been handling all of this?
He's been bad for the agency. He is making it a laughingstock right now. I don't know whether he's on some kind of an ego trip that he has to feel he's really important by sending staff out to do work for him, personal work. It seems as if he's done that. I don't know. We have to wait for his explanation. But it just, the denigration of science is, to me, the most egregious thing that's going on. I don't quite understand in the sense that there seems to be an ethical tone deafness. It's just beyond anything I would have conceived of.
We also learned in recent weeks that he barred the press from certain hearings. That seems to be a little unusual.
It's highly unusual. It's unhealthy for the country. It's unhealthy for the agency. It's one of those things that it just isn't serving anyone's best interests except maybe, you know, Scott Pruitt's, but how, I don't know. It's something that about which the public should be concerned. I mean, truly concerned. The fact that you have all these investigations going on, first of all, it takes away from the concentration of the agency to do anything else, which may be one of the things that is fine by them. But for the American public, this is an agency that was designed to protect their health and to protect their environment. And when you start to lose that focus and you start to lose the ability to do that, it's not healthy for the country.
What do you make of this all-out war against science? Where do you think this comes from?
It's twofold, because there has been this long-standing frustration, or there was, with the Obama administration because they did so much by regulation. And regulations are very easy to hate because they make you change behavior or spend money for problems you may not think really exist. I get that. That makes some sense. I understand it. But they also have this attitude that anything that has Obama's name anywhere around it is going to go, good, bad, or indifferent. And that's where you run into a problem. Is it reasonable to want to go back over and take a look at regulations to see whether situations have changed, whether the problems are not as great as they were originally thought, whether new technology has been developed that can supersede whatever the agency was requiring, the action the agency was requiring with the original rule? You know, that's all well and good, but that's not what's happening. It's not happening in a thoughtful way, from what I have seen. Denigrating science like this is putting us behind. I mean, we're going to start to be behind everybody. Right now, the Chinese are going to pass us in science, and we've always been at the cutting edge of science. We're not going to be anymore because we're giving up that advantage by saying, basically sending the message, science isn't important. We're really not going to pay any attention to it, and that's really dangerous in the long run.
Yeah, there was an article recently that sort of reiterated that Scott Pruitt's war on science is more dangerous than any of the scandals involving corruption.
I think so. It goes to the heart of the agency. It goes to the future.
Even if you put aside the what appears to be settled science regarding climate change and global warming, it would be hard to understand why someone would want less regulation when it comes to drinking water and clean air.
Hard for me to understand, but again, it's going back to it's not being thought through. It's just we're getting rid of regulations. I mean, the dirty little secret is they're not totally. They're doing real damage, but they're not getting rid of regulations, because if something has been found to be a problem for human health, if you've had an endangerment finding, you just don't get up one day and say, "Yep, no, don't think it's a problem anymore." You've got to go through a process to ensure, show what science you've come up with that proves it is no longer a problem. Maybe you have, but you need to go through that process. And so a lot of what he's doing will eventually be rolled back. I don't think it will stand the constitutional test, but the legal test. It won't even get as far as the Constitution. But that's still not going to make what's been happening at the agency any better, and he is doing damage. What's happening now is a lot of those actors, the bad actors, are, and even the good companies are saying, wait a minute, let's not spend any more money on this, on cleaning up our act, because we may not have to do it. And it's counterproductive, counterintuitive to saving human health. We know that between 2 and 300,000 people a year die in this country from dirty airborne-related causes. That's a lot of people.
Given that you ran this agency in a Republican White House, how do you feel watching what's happening to that agency?
I feel really badly for the agency and for the people who are still sticking it out. A lot of them aren't, and so we're losing some very important institutional knowledge, because it's not an easy agency. It's not a straightforward agency, because it is so constrained by the enabling legislation that the Congress enacted when they established it. So it's complicated, and you've got to know what you're doing. And so even if some people stay and people come back, you're not going to have the resources that you had, and it's going to take a long time to build up that base of knowledge again, and we pay a price.
All right, that's former EPA Administrator Christine Todd Whitman. We appreciate your perspective. Thank you for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impulga, the host of Reporters Roundtable. This week on Reporters Roundtable, a discussion of foreign aid and corruption in Africa. That's Reporters Roundtable this Thursday at 17:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. India is the global host of the 2018 World Environment Day, highlighting its best beat plastic pollution. Environmentalists will urge everyone, from those in government and industry as well as ordinary citizens, to reject the so-called single-use plastic items, which are slowly choking the planet's waters and the animals that live in them. VOA's George Pudich reports.
The gravity of the situation was brutally illustrated recently in Thailand, where a team of veterinarians lost a five-day battle to save a pilot whale, which wandered into one of the country's many canals. Its stomach contained 8 kilograms of bags and other pieces of plastic that the poor animal swallowed while swimming in heavily polluted waters.
It comes from Vietnam, China, Cambodia, and yes, from Thailand too. And it comes in many different forms. There's hospital and medical waste. Household items, lighters, and even children's shoes.
Rapidly developing countries in Southeast Asia are now dumping more plastic waste into the ocean than the rest of the world combined, and it's affecting not only the fish and other creatures in the sea, but people too. Experts agree that the fight must be fought on several fronts. One is educating people about the danger of plastic trash.
You actually are creating waste which is going to live far longer than you. So, and even when after 500 years they could photodegrade, but that doesn't mean they disappear. They just become microplastics, which are actually even more harmful.
The plastic bags that killed the pilot whale could be easily replaced with biodegradable products if consumers insisted on them in the marketplace.
When society will demand a jute bag instead or take a jute bag with them when they leave their homes, then automatically the movement of these plastic bags will die its own death. That is why we have said if everyone starts to contribute a little bit, then the environment will get better.
Experts fear that it will take a long time to change things, but they point out that regular volunteer cleanups, such as this one, organized by the Switzerland-based nonprofit Trash Hero, can help in preventing the planet from being suffocated by plastic waste. George Pudich, VOA News.
Well, the U.S. attracts the best and brightest talents from around the world, and for many, the path to success is quick and easy, but for others, it's long and challenging. For two ballerinas who moved to the U.S. from Ukraine and Armenia, dancing on the American stage has been a dream, and now they proudly call this stage their own. Karina Bafrajian has their story.
Sonia Haratyan grew up in Yerevan, Armenia. She always felt comfortable on stage. Watching her parents perform made her fall in love with the ballet and start attending a local ballet school. But after she moved to the U.S., she realized she would have to learn the art of dancing anew.
When I actually came more into, you know, seeing the companies and how things work here, it was very, very different. Big shock and, you know, different. The way they moved was different in the company, a lot faster, so I had to adjust a lot with my training too.
But hard work at the Washington School of Ballet paid off. After only a year, Sona was invited to join the permanent Washington Ballet Company. The Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland, the main role in Carmen. These are just a few of her star performances. Discipline and busy schedules, hard work and long rehearsals. This is something all ballet dancers know far too well, but Ukrainian ballet dancer Katerina Derechina believes such hardships only make her stronger. Katerina is in her sixth season with the Washington Ballet. She moved to the U.S. in 2001.
I wasn't expecting to stay how I did and work here, but I'm glad that happened. And I got opportunities to do different works, different choreography, and sort of like learning first time contemporary work and modern and jazz in school was something completely new to me. So it was really great.
But though both ballerinas now consider the U.S. their home, they wouldn't mind returning to their motherlands for a tour.
Yes, I would. I mean, I would love to guest or perform there. I don't know if I would live back in Ukraine. I haven't been there in a long time. Kind of my life sort of here.
Dance is universal. It has universal language. And no matter where you are, if that's what I chose to do, is my language, so I don't feel like this is my home or that one. As a whole, I can perform here, next day I can go back and dance there or go travel anywhere. And that's, I think, dance unites us all and transcends all them.
In May, Washington Ballet ended its season with Giselle, in which Sona played Bathilde and Katerina Mertha. Now the company has some time off until September, when the dancers will resume speaking the language of beauty and movement that everyone understands. Karina Befredjian for VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On July 17, 2014, a Malaysia Airlines passenger airplane, designated as Flight MH17, left Amsterdam for Kuala Lumpur with 298 passengers and crew. 3 hours into its flight, the airplane was shot out of the sky over eastern Ukraine. All 298 people on board died. Most of the victims were Dutch, Malaysians, and Australians. As a direct result of Russia's aggression in Ukraine, by mid-July 2014, Ukrainian security forces and Russia-led forces had been fighting in southeastern Ukraine for over 3 months. It is worth noting that on July 14th, just 3 days before MH17 was destroyed, two Ukrainian military aircraft were shot down by the Russia-led forces using Russian Buk surface-to-air missiles. The International Civil Aviation Organization warned governments not to overfly southeastern Ukraine, but this warning did not include the region where MH17 crashed. On May 24, 2018, a Dutch-led international team of investigators announced that Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 had been shot out of the sky by pro-Russian separatists using a Buk missile that had been transported into eastern Ukraine from a Russian military unit based in western Russia. The Buk missile was fired from Russia-controlled territory in eastern Ukraine. Because Russia provided the weapon, the Netherlands and Australia are seeking to hold Russia accountable for the tragedy. Despite these facts, Russia continues to deny its involvement. We strongly support the decisions by the Netherlands and Australia to call Russia to account for its role in the July 2014 downing of Malaysia Flight No. 17 over eastern Ukraine and the horrific deaths of 298 civilians. It is time for Russia to acknowledge its role in the shooting down of MH17 and to cease its callous disinformation campaign, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert in a written statement. As the findings of the joint investigative team made clear, the Buk missile launcher used to bring down the passenger aircraft is owned by the Russian Federation and was assigned to the Russian 53rd Anti-Aircraft Brigade near Kursk. It was brought into sovereign Ukrainian territory from Russia, was fired from territory controlled by Russia and Russian-led forces in eastern Ukraine, and was then returned to Russian territory. We urge Russia to adhere to UNSCR 2166 and respond to Australia's and the Netherlands' legitimate requests.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.